On October 29, 1918, only a few days before the official end of World War I, in Kiel, a naval port on Germany's northern coast, sailors in the German Imperial Navy staged a mutiny that would spark revolutions across Germany, would lead to the formation of a new state with a constitution recognizing radical new human rights, and ultimately would lead to the rise of the Nazi Party. The sailors were responding to the unauthorized decision by the Imperial Navy Command to take the entire fleet and engage in one final suicidal battle against the Royal Navy. The German naval officers believed it was better for the sailors to die gloriously in battle at sea than to accept the upcoming so-called dishonorable peace settlement and go home alive. The sailors, however, thought differently. Welcome to the Weimar Spectacle, where I explore the brief and extraordinary life of the Weimar Republic. I'm Bremner Fletcher, singer, actor, and theater maker. I've spent years performing songs and theater from the Weimar period, and I'm inspired and maybe more than a little obsessed by that moment in time. You'll find a transcript of this episode and photographs and images on my website at bremnersings.com, BREMNERSINGS.com. So, my big idea for these podcasts is that the Weimar Republic invented everything about the modern world, and we are all still dealing with the possibilities and problems it gave to us. To prove this possibly unprovable idea, I'll be exploring the arts, politics, science, architecture, social innovations of the Weimar period, and the terrible and irresistible rise of the Nazi Party. So, if you're an amateur astronomer who wants to know why in Potsdam, Germany, there is an innovative astrophysical observatory called the Einstein Tower that is still studied by modern architecture students, or maybe you're a graphic designer who wants to escape the computer screen, go old school, and find out exactly what kind of glue George Grosz used in his radical and revolutionary collages, well, this is the show for you. So back to the mutiny. About a month before the mutiny, on the 3rd of October 1918, the new German government led by Prince Max von Baden began an exchange of diplomatic notes with U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, requesting that Wilson bring an end to the war. However, the leadership of the German Navy refused to believe Germany was defeated. Over the course of that month, as terms of an armistice were being finalized, the German Navy's highest command set up secret plans for a major assault on the Royal Navy. The German Navy had been held in reserve for most of the war, and they feared the officer corps would lose honor if the war came to an end without the full deployment of the fleet. They also believed the Navy's glorious sacrifice would reignite the German population's desire to continue with the war. However, just as they were about to set out, sailors on board three ships refused to weigh anchor, and some of them committed outright mutiny and sabotage. When loyal boats aimed their cannons at those ships, the mutineers surrendered. But the Navy command felt that the crew's loyalty could not be relied upon, so the battle squadron was ordered back to Kiel. Desperately trying to prevent the fleet setting sail again, and to find a way to release their comrades, 250 sailors met in the evening of the 1st of November and sent delegations to their officers requesting the mutineers' release. But instead, their meeting place was closed and locked by the police, leading to an open-air meeting on the 2nd of November, where the sailors called for a mass meeting the following day. And on the 3rd of November, in the afternoon, several thousand people, along with workers' representatives from various Kiel industries, met under the banner of Peace and Bread, Frieden und Brot, demanding not only the release of the prisoners, but also the end of the war and better food. The Navy was renowned for the terrible, terrible food it fed the common soldiers, sailors, and the luxury of the officers' tables. Eventually, this group began to march peacefully towards the military prison, but when soldiers fired live rounds into the march, killing 7 people and wounding 30, the protest turned into a revolt. On the morning of the 4th of November, mutineers moved through the city of Kiel looking for support. Sailors from a large barracks outside the town joined the mutiny, and that day the first Sailors' Council was set up. Sailors' councils were set up to bring public and military institutions under control. And when the officers broke their promises and sent troops in to break up the rebellion, those troops were either sent back or they joined the rebellion. By the evening of the 4th of November, Kiel was firmly in the hands of about 40,000 rebellious sailors, soldiers, and workers. The mutineers set up the first examples of what would be the defining institutions of the German Revolution, a workers' council, similar to what had happened previously in Russia where councils called Soviets were set up. Eventually across Germany, there were factory workers' councils, soldiers' councils, miners' councils, and even artists' councils. They were a kind of grassroots democracy, not unlike the Occupy Wall Street movement from the 2000s, where groups came together to debate and form policy. In 1918, workers on strike, soldiers who disliked orders, artists planning a new gallery or theater show might elect a council to guide them on how to move forward, and they'd make decisions collectively, then delegate members who would negotiate terms with the authorities and who would come back and report, and the next step would again be decided by the collective. As these councils gained powers in cities across Germany, they took charge of civil servants and governing bodies, and they brought a hope of a deep change to a country that had previously been governed in a completely top-down authoritarian system. And also, as they gained power, they raised immense fear and loathing in Germany's ruling classes, as just to the east in Russia, they saw how those Soviets had attacked and destroyed their own class. Around the 4th of November, delegates from the sailors travel by train to all the country's big cities, and by the 7th of November, 3 days later, the revolution has seized all larger coastal cities, as well as Hanover, Brunswick, Frankfurt on Main, and Munich. In Munich, a workers' and soldiers' council forces the last king of Bavaria, Ludwig III, to abdicate. And in the following days, the royal rulers of all German states abdicate. And on November 9th, Kaiser Wilhelm, King of Prussia, Margrave of Brandenburg. Let me start that again and see if I can get this title right. This is the short version. Kaiser Wilhelm, King of Prussia, Margrave of Brandenburg, Sovereign and Supreme Duke of Silesia, Grand Duke of the Lower Rhine and Posen, Duke of Saxony, Westphalia and Pomerania, of Lüneburg and Bremen, of Holstein, Schleswig and Lauenburg, Landgrave of Hesse, Prince of East Frisia, Osnabrück and Hildesheim, of Nassau and Fulda, Count of Hohenzollern, Lord of Frankfurt and the last Emperor of Germany, abdicates and leaves the country. But maybe all of this should not have come as such a surprise, because for the generals running Germany's imperial military forces, Germany's desperate situation had been evident for some time. In September 1918, the leaders of Germany's military, Field Marshal Hindenburg and General Erich Ludendorff, began planning an end to the war and the transition to a civilian, limited parliamentary democracy. However, this transition to democracy was not from any sense of democratic ideals. Instead, they had decided they had to pass the symbolic responsibility and guilt for ending the war and declaring Germany's surrender into the hands of politicians, and so escape that stain on the officers' corps of the army. And they did. With the Kaiser's blessing in October of 1918, a limited civilian constitutional government was established. And this attempt to pass responsibility for the surrender worked so successfully that it gave rise to one of Hitler's major talking points, the so-called stab in the back. The theory that Germany's successful World War I campaign had been betrayed by Jewish politicians, and if not for them, Germany would have gone on to win World War I. However, in early November 1918, as the revolutionary councils spread across Germany and public squares fill with demonstrators, it is evident that larger concessions would need to be made to bleed off the energy from the revolutionary movement. So the head of the provisional civilian government, Prince Max von Baden, who was set into power by the Kaiser and Ludendorff, passes over control to the head of Germany's moderate center-left Social Democratic Party. However, this was going to be anything but a smooth transition. Instead, in two completely unsanctioned declarations, the head of the Social Democratic Party steps onto the balcony of the Reichstag and declares that from that moment on, Germany was now a republic. And, at almost the same time, from a balcony of the Royal Palace, the radical socialist and anti-war activist Karl Liebknecht declares that Germany is now a socialist republic. And at that point, all hell breaks loose. You see, Germans at this moment are not simply eager for change, they are a powder keg waiting to explode with change. As World War I ends, millions of soldiers, many of them traumatized by the brutality of the trenches, are flooding back into the country, often still holding their weapons. And at the same time, since the Kaiser had turned the whole country into a war machine, industries that had been on overdrive to support the war are firing workers and shutting factories, and most of those workers are women. Hired during the war to replace men sent to the front, so now trained, skilled, newly empowered women are being sent back to their villages, partly because the industries are scaling back, but mostly by order of the German government to allow returning soldiers to step back into their old jobs in the hopes that steady work would diffuse their potential for violence. One manufacturer, Krupp Industries, only 3 weeks after the end of the war, has already fired 52,000 workers and kicked them out of their industry housing. And of those nearly 30,000 female workers in that number, only 500 get to keep their jobs. However, beyond vaguely hoping they would find work, the government has no plan on how to reincorporate these traumatized soldiers and newly empowered women. City officials print leaflets telling returning soldiers to keep moving and return to their villages, and that they will be refused any aid and shelter in cities. However, what the soldiers and women do instead is to involve themselves in the new politics, join discussion groups in public squares, form soldiers and workers' councils of their own. And they are so inspired by the huge changes happening around them. In Bavaria, when the arch-conservative, militaristic, reactionary Catholic King Ludwig III is overthrown, workers and soldiers nominate Kurt Eisner, a literary critic, a pacifist and anti-militarist, as president of the People's State of Bavaria. The soldiers, and along with them the women, who are soon to be given the vote for the first time, plunge into politics, demanding respect and new working conditions. However, they're not all moving to the left. Oswald Spengler, a conservative writer, says, quote, "I am choking with disgust the way that Kaiser Wilhelm was chased away. He had sacrificed himself for the greatness of Germany. We need some harsh punishments until the time is ready for a small group to be called to leadership. A lot of blood has to flow, the more the better." Many people are moving to the right wing, and some ex-soldiers find a place in the Freikorps. The Freikorps is an unofficial paramilitary group who start a campaign of brutality and assassination. They were sponsored by the army in response to restrictions on the army's size and power. And in a fateful step that would, years later, come back to haunt them and eventually lead to the downfall of the Weimar Republic and all its dreams, the new socialist government joins forces with the right wing and the right wing paramilitary groups to attack the workers demanding new rights and powers. You see, the SDP, the Social Democratic Party, who now had power after the Kaiser had abdicated, was a center-left liberal party, and they fully intended to implement huge reforms in Germany, to bring in better working conditions, ensure health care, empower women, create a working democracy. But they viewed the workers' councils around Germany as agents of chaos that would prevent those changes. And to be fair to the SDP, just to the east, they could see the Bolshevik Revolution descending into civil war, starvation, and the terrifying brutality of political terror and repression. And also, in absolutely typical left-wing fashion, the various factions of the German left, the communists, the socialists, the anarchists, the anarcho-syndicalists, and Spartacists, had already begun to view each other as enemies almost equal to the old regime. So the SDP was working furiously to try and channel all these competing energies in the hopes of avoiding a civil war. They decide to channel all those forces through the most democratic process available, a popular vote. A brand new constitution will be created for a brand new democracy, and they hope that that move will bleed off the popularity of the radical groups and destroy the legitimacy of the workers' councils. They realize that Germany needs to make a massive shift to a modern post-war economy, and also they simply need to keep people alive. Food and coal has to be found. People have to get put back to work. Democratic institutions need to be constructed from scratch. However, their problem is that the SDP has never, ever held power. It's filled with very smart people who are brilliant party organizers, but they have no experience in running a state, running the trains, keeping sewerage and water working, maintaining a police force. So, to keep chaos in check, the SDP strikes deals with the devil. They make deals with the most conservative elements of the old regime. The old army officer corps will be left in place if they support the new government and supply soldiers to control the workers' councils. Industry will be left in private hands if they agree to recognize trade unions. Civil servants of the old imperial regime will keep their jobs if they agree to help out with the new democratic system. And these deals do work for a time, or at least they work for as long as those old institutions are staring right down the barrel of the possibility of a total overthrow by the workers, as they see happening in Russia. But only a few years later, when the Weimar Republic is trying to live up to its idealistic beginning, those same conservative reactionary forces, still holding positions of power, would be doing everything they could to work towards the overthrow of the Republic and the reestablishment of a conservative regime. A struggle that would encourage and open up a space for the rise of the Nazi Party. So in 1918, as the winter progresses, the ruling SDP does get support from the various workers' councils for a democratic vote for an elected assembly that would both draw up a new constitution and function as the new parliament. However, in December and January, the military, in a series of bloody conflicts, suppresses the soldiers' councils, takes back control of its forces, and, since there are now new rules about the size and behavior of the army, it begins to set up those paramilitary groups to destroy the workers' councils around the country. The two major left-wing leaders, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, are assassinated, and those killings mark the beginning of right-wing murders across the country. And these are supported by the SDP. The defense minister of the SDP, in response to worker strikes, writes, quote, "Every person who is found fighting with arms in the hand against government troops is to be immediately shot." So during this period of small-scale civil war and uprisings and street battles, they do hold the vote, and Germans do turn up in record numbers. The big new unknown is the vote of women, who are newly enfranchised, and it turns out they vote, by and large, for the conservative parties and the Catholic Center Party. However, the SDP manages to form a minority coalition, but they are in parliament with members already advocating for the abolition of the institution. To write the constitution, they decide to leave Berlin and move to the old city of Weimar. Partly because of the ongoing street fighting between right-wing paramilitary groups and left-wing factions, and also because they believe that the idea of Weimar, which in the 17th and 18th century was the center of the German Enlightenment and had been home to many literary figures and was now a kind of symbol of classical German culture, would help the new republic gain the moral support of conservative Germans. And so it begins. The Weimar Republic. Born out of high ideals and terrible bloody compromises, out of struggle between old authority and the 19th and 20th century struggle for human rights, out of political extremism of the worst kind on both sides of the political divide, and out of a desire for national healing after what had been, up to that time, the most brutal, devastating war in human history. Despite their differences, on the 11th of August, 1919, the Assembly comes up with a document that protects basic liberties like freedom of speech and the press, declares the equality of women and men, establishes free and equal voting rights for all German citizens from the age of 21, makes collective bargaining between workers and industry legally binding, declares state responsibility for the unemployed and for mothers and children, and establishes Germany as a federal system of 18 states elected through proportional representation. It's a shining embodiment of the high ideals of the European democratic socialist movements. Revolutions against authoritarian governments had swept across Germany for centuries, and finally a clear document had set their desires onto paper. But it also created a fractured democracy, with political groups at each other's throats, refusing all compromise, and with a parliament which was often completely blocked as members refused to work together, and instead collaborated with groups outside parliament who were trying to destroy the human rights that the parliament was set up to uphold. And it set the stage for a right-wing demagogue to be legally elected, a demagogue who would then claim to be the only legitimate authority and would manipulate the rules in that constitution to shut down the democratic process, which, sadly, brings me right back to the present day, February 2024, and the big idea of this whole podcast series, which is, if some of those concerns and desires and fears seem familiar, well, they should, because I believe the Weimar Republic helped give birth to the modern world. Thank you for listening. Hit subscribe or follow if you want to know when the next episode appears, and I don't have any advertising budget for this show. I'm just some obsessed singer repurposing a studio mic. So if you leave a review or hit the star button, it really encourages the podcast to be found by other listeners. So that'd be just great as well. And I hope you'll join me in the coming months as I explore more about the strange birth, life, and death of an experiment in creating a new society. I'll put images for this episode onto my website, bremnersings.com, bremnersings.com. You'll see examples of the sailors' mutiny, the street fighting in Berlin from leftists and the right-wing Freikorps, the martyred leftist leaders Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. I have a nice picture of the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which kind of sounds like something from a science fiction novel of alternate timelines. And, of course, the mad, brilliant general at the head of the Imperial military, Erich Ludendorff. You have to see him. He looks pretty much exactly like central casting needed an evil general. And who am I to discuss Weimar? Well, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a political scientist or a historian. I am an obsessive artist. A singer, a playwright, a cabaret performer who's been obsessed with the arts and music of the Weimar Republic all my life. I've recorded 3 albums dedicated to the music of this time, and particularly the music of Kurt Weill. If you want to listen to them, just search for Bremner Fletcher in any music streaming site, and you'll find all my albums. And if you want to know more about my work, see the images from this period, or read the transcript of the episode, or maybe suggest a specific Weimar subject for an episode, check out bremnersings.com, bremnersings.com. So join me next time for a walk through the amazing creative madness of 1920s Germany, and I'll do a first dive into the artistic revolutions that were inspired by that madness. Thank you. Bye.